Exertion number 31400, reel 4.
Reel 4. So that period, was it relatively quiet then? You and your nail said it wasn't, there was the mortaring but not?
Yeah, it was just quiet. You know, you'd fire some rounds into the green zone and you'd hear them come up on ICOM, you know, who's firing? And they'd go, it's not me, brother, I'm doing this for Jihad. And you think, oh, whatever, just chatting crap. But it was quiet, it was sort of more like a pass through from until we were told we'd go into Kajaki.
Can you describe to me Kajaki as the kind of location and why that's different from the other places?
Desolate. No, from the Kajaki DC and the peaks, you can see out for miles. You know, about 6K is about, is, you know, you've got about 2-3K away. You've got Bakakal, Magakal. You've got, you know, China Bypass, which is Wadi. You've got Kavalabad, which is next to Mazdarak. Kaki Jinan, or as some agents know, used to call it Kakyor Jinans, because it was, you know, it was mad. And it was just, you'd guaranteed to have a contact every time you went out.
You know. Are you based around the dam up there?
Yeah, you're protecting the dam, that's your main objective, to keep Taliban out.
And are these most of the places that you're going to have contact with? Is that north of the, am I right in thinking that's north of the dam?
North and south, you know, Kajaki Oila was a southern flat. And, you know, you'd go down there. And you'd rock up at compound 105 fire support, and you'd be smashing compounds 250, 251, 252, big top, which was just, you know, forward, and everything really. You'd smash it. You'd have a contact all the time, no matter whether you're north or south. You'd always have a contact.
And you were targeting, obviously, at this stage, this is where you said you fired the majority of the javelins.
Yeah.
What were you targeting on those occasions? What were the things that you were looking for?
My first javelin, I took out 3 Taliban with 1 missile. My other ones, I was firing into buildings, like windows, doorways, into wadis. One of my missiles went rogue and went about 7K, so I could have hit anything. You know, jump lock and went for miles. But no, if they're firing at a firing point, they'd say, right, put a javelin into it.
So they would say to you, can you hit that wadi at that position along there, and you'd lock onto that?
Yeah, you'd scan around your area with infrared, or like your sights, and if you could see enemy, you'd look on the clue, and if you could pick up a heat source, and you could POID it was Taliban, because there'd be no one else out there, then if you pass out the chain, you'd probably be tasked to engage with javelin. From then, you'd engage, and more like you'd 90% get a kill.
Would you get feedback from that, or how would you know how successfully you've
been? My first missile was being spotted by OCB company, so he came up on the net, nice, get it, be the AF3. So, you know, I killed 3 Taliban. That's sniper spotters on it, snipers engaging as well. So, you know, it felt good actually to have my first missile 100% hit.
Well, there must be a certain amount of professional satisfaction that you're doing exactly what you trained for, and it's actually had a distinct impression on the battle. Yeah,
just by doing it, you're doing your job. So, you know what you're doing. You know, you're happy with doing that. You know, you are getting job satisfaction because it's what you've trained for, and you think, instead of all the time with drill rounds being nice as shit, you know, I'm firing, you know, it's not real. Fire, oh, it's not real. Oh wow, I hit it, it's not real. You know, this time, you know, as you're firing, a missile is actually leaving the tube. It's leaving your launch tube assembly, and you're seeing it go. I mean, it's gone. I mean, you watch the target, I mean, you see it hit. You'll see the soft launch, and it go.
And the other targets you mentioned, obviously, firing into, again, were you being told they're in that building there, can you put...
Yeah, if you can idea a firing point, let's say, right, smash it with javelin, and you'd put a javelin through the roof or through the window or a door. You know, whether it be top attack or direct, you'd smash it. And that's what we used to do. We even used javelin as markers for fast air. If the pilot can't see where you're firing into, if he's foreign, you know, I'm not saying there's anything it's foreign pilots or whatever, but if they're not used to the ground, you say, right, we're going to put a javelin in, fire at the smoke, and you do it. You know, and they'd, yep, yeah, okay, I'm on target, and they'd drop a £500 or a £1,000 or give it a strafe run or whatever.
And would that usually sort of suppress any other...
Sometimes it wouldn't. You'd make more or less the time you'd drop fast air, you'd drop a bomb on them, and it'd go quiet. But sometimes, once you've done it, they'd open up somewhere else, so you'd still be in contact.
Do they, as well, do they use... I mean, have they got really poor radio discipline most of the time? Are they chattering on there?
Yeah, they chat shit. Talk about President Bush is dead and what we're doing for the cause of jihad and I nicked your bike. I'm sorry, brother. I gave it a puncher.
But does that... I mean, that gives away, obviously, where they are, doesn't it? And that's they're around,
you
aren't they?
Yeah, you know, they're quite close. But, you know, they used to say things like, you know, excuse my language, like, you know, fuck jihad, I hate it, I'm going home. Why are we doing this for him? He nicked my milk. And you think, well, you know, it's just mental. Yeah, where are them shots coming from? I've killed them. Who? I killed 10 British soldiers. And it was like, oh, well done, brother. Good cause for jihad. And you're thinking, what are you on?
Aside from that, what impressions did you get of their kind of fighting quality?
They're good. They are good. You know, to some extent, we trained them. You know, they use the same tactics we do. They go out in patrol formation, they attack with infantry skills, dropping off a fire support and bounding forward, extracting, you know, no movement without fire. They do the same as us. We've been in buildings where they've got a medical centre, where they've got a learning centre with pictures of Wemmicks or Vectors or Land Rovers on the walls, or Vikings, where they've drawn them on. So they're not thick. They've done their research and they know, you know, to some extent, if they're going to hit us, how they're going to hit us. So, you know, they're not... Like I said, people don't understand, you know, they're not thick.
So they have the same sort of, as you say, the same structure?
They've got a cardiovac chain, you know. They have... We've seen them drop off ammo in battles. They've got a CQMS chain to some extent. They do the same as us. It's mad. Until you see it for real, you can't explain it. You know, it's all well and good talking to people about what you've done and what you've seen, but like, you know, like most things, unless you've seen it or done it yourself, you can't explain it because it's mad. If you go in a pub and say to someone, yeah, Taliban do the same as me, they'll think, sort of dickhead, as if. You know, but it's true, you know, they do the same as us, same patrol formations, arrowhead, anything, you know, have sentries out in the buildings, they...
And of course, I would suggest that they've got the tradition as well, haven't they? They're almost constantly fighting for the last 30-odd years.
Yeah, that's what they used to, you know, they do it for jihad, and they do it for Islam, and the Quran, and the Prophet, and they love it. They're willing to die, so they don't care. They don't care if they die because they get their 40 virgins or whatever. No, they don't care. You know, it's if it was insurgents in Iraq and that, you know, they're not all Iraqis, you know, they're from all around the world. But these are people from Afghanistan and Pakistan who are willing to die, so it makes it, they're more determined.
With that though, the Taliban that you were meeting in Afghanistan, you mentioned someone from Pakistan. Is there any evidence about the kind of foreign fighters that you'd come across?
Yeah, some of them were wearing Pakistani commando uniforms, you know, and we've arrested people who were from Birmingham, who were Taliban, you know, who were British fighting against us. You know, it's... But, you know, they say there's no Pakistanis in there, but, you know, there blatantly is. And it's like, you know, I remember one of my friends telling me in 2002 when they was in Kabul, a battalion, they stopped someone at a checkpoint, and he was from Birmingham. He said, you know, it's like, it's all right, mate, I'm just here to see my family. And I'm like, well, you're from Birmingham. He's like, yeah, you know, my family, I'm Afghani. My family live in Kabul, and when it kicked off, I got on a flight and come out here. So, you know, you think, well, why? You know, yeah, it's family matters, yeah, fair one, but it's still strange to think about. You know, that was in 2002, 5 years on. You know, same thing.
When you were based at Kajaki, did you do any, obviously, any of the kind of operations on foot at all?
Yeah, most of them on foot.
So you were patrolling from a certain point, were you?
Kajaki DC. You're travelling south, you'd go vehicle, unless you was dismounted fire support. Mainly, if you'd go anywhere past Bagger Cow, you'd go either on foot up to Essex Ridge for the Wimmix for fire support, or you'd dismount and take javelin kit, GPM GSF, and you'd just carry loads of weight, have a massive firefight, and then extract back and come back shattered, clean your weapons and go to bed.
Would that kind of, the firefights that you were doing at that stage, would it just be almost a daily thing?
Yeah, we're so used to it, you just think, oh, here we go again. You know, how long are we going to be out for? You used to have bets on how long we're going to stay out for. A couple of hours, yeah, I reckon so. You spend all your ammo, you're out of ammo, right, it's bug out.
And obviously, you're saying that as you were getting used to it. Is there a point where you get used to being under fire?
Yeah, you have to get used to it, because first time you're a bit shaky and you're scared, and you are. If you talk to anyone and you say they're not scared, then they're lying, because you do. You know, I thought I was all right until we got bombed in Kajaki, the blue on blue. I mean, that was it for me. I didn't want to be there no more.
With that situation, is there a change then in your outlook? Is that common amongst a lot of your mates as well? Do you get to a point where you think, I know what this is like, I know what's going to happen?
Yeah, nearer the end of the tour, I didn't want to be there anyway because of what had happened. And you just, whether it's happened the whole tour and you haven't realised it until then, but you start hearing rounds go whanging past your head more. And you think, fucking, I'm going home in 3 weeks, I don't want to die now. You think, Jesus Christ.
Were you counting off the days at that point?
It's hard not to, but you know that you're going to be relieved on like the 19th, and it's like the 2nd, and you think there's 17 days left, you know, 9 more patrols.
The blue on blue incident, was that a big factor on morale?
Yeah, massively. Massively. Shouldn't have happened.
But obviously, again, how it was perceived in the UK, I think, was obviously the media portrayed it as, you know, the Americans have bombed our troops again. How did people in the company view it really at that stage?
As an accident. Obviously, there was a lot more to it, you know, and there is a lot more to it than what's, you know, being said or been said. You know, it's, you know, that's not up for me to, you know, disclose or, you know, say, because it's all over my head. It's all to do with Whitehall and everyone in the investigation. But, you know, the bottom line was, it was our first night patrol, and we was out on the ground. We come under contact as usual. Was in contact for about 2-3 hours. Called in fast air. We was told it was coming into compound 10 Rizaji, which was about 800 metres to my right. As I've looked at it, bomb went off a K to my left in Mazdarak. And, you know, everyone was like, yeah, fucking hell, woo, you know. But then when you think about it, you thought, hang on a minute, that's hit the wrong place. And before you know it, your radio's going AWOR with, you know, reports of 2 T4s, 2 T1s, immediate medevac, cadivac now. And that's when you think to yourself, shit, we're in the shit. You know, we had 2 T4s, you know, one good friend of mine was killed. You know, we got back into the DC after having, you know, both the T4s, you know, be airlifted back to Bastion, you know, their bodies, and the two T1s, who were in a serious condition, you know. Parky was in a bad way, big time, he was in a bad way. I remember getting back, I remember throwing my kit down in my room, and I was gutted because I was only chatting to John a couple of hours before about when we go home, you know, we're going to go out on the beer, because he only lived up the road from me, you know, a couple of hours later he's dead, it's mad, you know. I remember throwing my kit down, and the side major calling me, and I went out and he said, "Get your kit back on, mate, we're going back out." I was like, right, okay, didn't ask why. Obviously I was angry at this point, I wanted to go out and smash Taliban, I just weren't interested no more, I wanted to go and get payback sort of thing. When we was loading up, I asked what was going on, and we told we're going out because we were missing a man. You know, and it was Fozzie, it was Foster. You know, we stayed there all night digging him out.
Was he trapped when the
building collapsed? Yeah. You know, he was crushed. You know, we found him. He got airlifted out, but you know, at that point when we got there, we got support from Brigade Recce Force, BRF, SAS, and SBS, who came out to secure the town and give us what support we needed. You know, to get our mate out of the rubble. If he was in there, we had no idea at that point.
What state was he in when you got him out?
K.I. T4. He was dead. You know, that was three T4s. You know, all from the same platoon. You know, that was the whole fire team wiped out. You know, and that for me did it. You know, I remember the next day. It was on the news. I remember phoning my mum, and I just remember I was in tears. I didn't want to do this job no more. You know, I'd had as much as I could take. I'd seen, you know, I'd seen my mates killed, and I'd seen, you know, I tried to save one of my mates' life back in May, and it just weren't what I wanted to do anymore.
So how did you come to terms with that, obviously? At that point, because you still had
some
time left, didn't you?
Yeah, we had a few months left. I just didn't want to be there. You know, I don't think I've blocked it out, but I don't think now I sort of got over it. Really, I think it's affected me in some way. You know, because it does. You always think about it. You think, well, you know, when Colt Davy was killed, you know, when the firearm was accident, what took his life. You know, I was in the RAP with him trying to save his life. And that's something I'll never forget.
Again, what had happened there?
We was in Sangin. They were cleaning weapons. And I remember I was in the DC and I heard a gunshot. And I thought it was my mate, because my best mate Jay was going to go and talk to the RNA and see where we can look at a pistol. You know, my best mate Jay, out on the tour. And he's at the RNA, but he's a good mate. And I thought, oh, you know, my first thing was, I think Jay's shot himself because he's gone to play fucking pistols with the RNA. I was running down, you know, they're carrying him to a stretcher. I was like, what's happened? This is George's shot himself. And it was accidental. You know, so, you know, you grab end of a stretcher, run him down to the RAP. We get in the RAP and I stayed there and said to the doc, is there anything I can do? He said, yeah, keep pressure on his wound. Keep talking to him. By this point, now the RSM, but Sir Major B Company, Sir Major Newton at the time, RSM Newton, was talking to him, holding his head, telling him, you know, he's going to be okay and that we're going to, he's getting help. You know, it was all right until we started being sick, you know, pure red blood. You know yourself then, something's bad. It was pure red. It was just spraying. And the first time it was all over the floor, and it was all up my boots and on my trousers. Second time it was in a bucket, but he flopped. and I thought he was dead. And when he sort of snapped out of it, I said, like, you know, it's like, he started crying. I said, oh, you know, I want to go. I want to go. And I remember OC, Major Mick Ashton, or Major Mick Ashton MC, he is now, or Mick Ashton MC, I don't know his rank now, so excuse me. But he said, you know, Strikey, go and find out along this Chinook is. So I went down there, and I didn't have a time, and I remember him going mental, saying, look, you know, one of my blokes is dying, you either give me a fucking time now, and we'll just do it ourselves. And they were like, ETA, 10 minutes. You know, he got on the chopper, he was stabilised, we went out on a patrol, because, you know, we don't stop just because of what's happened. Come back in the next morning, and he was dead. We got told he'd died. Internal bleeding. You know, I was gutted, I didn't believe it, but that's, you know, like anything, you get on with it.
Does it help that, a little bit, that getting on with it attitude that you have to take and carry on doing the job at the time?
You have to get on with it. If you fall apart, you're putting the rest of your mates in danger. You know, I spoke to Sergeant Major, you know, Sergeant Major Snow, and I spoke to Sergeant Major Newton, and they were like, they'd done out what you've done, what you could have done. It wouldn't have stopped him from dying. You know, it's just the way it is. You've done what you could. You know, you put all your training, you know, into action. And it didn't help, you know, but it's one of them things, it's life.
How did the tour come to an end? Obviously, you were...
Yeah, we finished our tour at Kajaki. Royal Marines took over, 4-2 Commando took over.
Did you give them any kind of a handover at all?
Yeah, we gave them familiarisation, patrols. You know, this is Masdarak, this is Shrine, this is where you go on Shrine, this is where the main points of, you know, enemy firing comes from, you know. Down Kajaki South, this is Compound 105, your main points of interest are, you know, showed them out of the vehicles, how we laid them out, and how we had done for 6 months, and how it works for us. They weren't really interested in that. They changed it all around, then asked us how it went, you know, so they obviously thought, you know, I think their attitude was, you know, we're Royal Marines, we just do things our way because, you know, we're better than everyone else. But as it turned out, the way we had our SOPs were actually better, so they changed back to how we operate.
Because you've been...
We've been there, you know, whether they'd been there before or not, I think they were quite arrogant, really. They come across, some of them, it's not all of them, some of them come across as arrogant. But, you know, some of them who were there for the takeover were actually killed in Afghanistan. So, you know, not saying it's their fault, but, you know, they died in Kajaki. You know, a lot of people thought, you know, we was making it up how bad it was. You know, we gave over the best brief we could, you know, from my level, private soldier, up to officer level. We gave them tips and everything the best we could, and whether they took it on board or done it is up to them. You know, in the day, everyone's different. But now we came home. We had our medal parade in Pirbright. Went on 6 weeks leave.
And then back to Pirbright.
Yeah, back to Pirbright, where it was more or less a training year. It was a bit more chilled out, but it was a training year. Went to Northern Ireland in May, just for a few weeks, for public order, just to do public order in West Belfast and Ballykinla. Just training.
Did anything happen?
No, it was just training in Ballykinla. Come back, and up till now we've just been training for operations, where we're now spearhead lead element, SLE.
Obviously now, looking back on the experience in Helmand, how do you look at it back now on the 18 months?
It's made a man out of me, even more than before. It's made me into a soldier I am.
And is there a certain professional satisfaction of being in that kind of situation, that you've been in a very active...
Yeah, I've done what I wanted to do in my career. You know, see live combat and actually engage enemy, and that's what I've done. You know, and as I'm concerned myself, doing, you know, it's made me a better soldier. You know, everything I've done has been put into perspective, and I've learned, you know, where I went out on Herrick as a BOD, as a javelin gunner. At the end of it all, I was commanding a 4-man Wimmick team as a private soldier. So, yeah, I've proved myself, and I've done what I need to do.